Well, I don't have time to read testing news at the moment.
Well, some of the specific feedback...
Too busy testing.
But some of the specific feedback that we got was we should do a new segment.
Oh, I remember that. We should do a segment with news and then we should do other things.
So what testing news is there this week?
No, I haven't been reading it.
My name's Bruce McLeod.
Oh, good to see you, Bruce. You're here for the senior test analyst position.
Yes. I'd like to apply for that position.
Oh, great. All right. Have a seat.
Thank you.
Yeah. How long have you been testing?
Five years.
5 years.
As a senior test analyst. If I was a manager, I would have more experience, but I'm only a senior analyst, so five years.
Well, okay. That seems perfectly reasonable for a senior test analyst position.
15.
What was that? Oh, okay. Well, I'll give you my first interview question.
Sure.
Okay, so let's say you've got a wine glass and you've been asked to test the wine glass. How would you test it?
I've got a wine glass. Okay, so can I ask a few framing...
You can ask whatever you like.
Okay, so what is the... Before I actually go and jump in and test this wine glass...
Uh-huh.
Is it a wine glass that's going to be sold commercially, mass market? Is it something that's a premium, one-off, custom wine glass for a single customer? Is it a prototype for mass market? What's the role for this wine glass? What's its end product, end use?
Well, these are all very good questions. Let's just say, I don't know, I'm just the guy who told you to test the wine glass.
Okay, so the reason I'm asking those questions is I'm trying to determine what is appropriate. So, for example, some of the things I might want to test on wine glass is glass thickness or material contents,
mm-hmm.
or if I drop it from a certain height, is it supposed to break or not? So that's why I want to try and better understand the end use of it, because if it was, for example, if it's a wine glass that is aimed to be used by the pool, around the pool, and it's to be durable and fall over and knocks, that would have very different testing requirements than if it was, for example, a nice crystal glass that you would only serve to, for example, the Queen of England. So, if there is no specific requirement for that, I'll just test a generic wine glass. Okay, so what I would want to test for a wine glass is, firstly, its ability to hold liquid. So,
believe it, it's supposed to hold liquid.
Sorry?
What did you say? You're making an assumption that it's supposed to hold liquid?
Well, it is a wine glass. Now, if I look up the dictionary definitions of wine, it would be a liquid.
That's true.
And a glass is normally a vessel that's used to hold a liquid with the view of consumption by a human being.
That's a fair assumption. I'll give you that. It could be an ornamental wine glass.
But I did ask some questions before to try and frame that. You said, I don't care, it's just a generic glass.
That's exactly what I said. And I'm just pointing out it's an assumption. And
That's fine.
Good assumption.
So the assumption is it's going to hold some liquid. So then I would then ask, is there a specific volume it's about to hold? Now, I could probably tell this I don't have a physical glass with me. If I could, I could probably tell from the size if it's looking to be like a standard drink or not. So I would then look at, is there a specific, how much liquid can it hold?
Yep.
How much can it hold? The whether, if I put a cold beverage in it, is it thick enough, or does it suddenly condense on the outside or not? So does the outside get wet and cold to the touch or not?
Oh, interesting.
The height and stability. So, for example, if it's actually, it might look lovely and full and be able to sit on the table when empty, but when it's full, the center of gravity might knock it over. So I might actually look at how easy it is to knock over, whether I can just tap it very, very easily and it just falls straight over, or
whether it's not.
So look at that. I would dip my finger into the liquid and see if I can do that nice ringy noise around the top, because that's always cool for a wine glass as well.
That's
pretty important on a wine glass.
Yeah,
the tap test as well. What sound does it make for impressing your friends? Do you want that nice crystal ting or not? Also, you can say how many different notes could you play. But I digress. I'm getting more into the secondary use of the wine glass as opposed to the primary.
Well, that's okay. I mean, in the end, you're just giving information about the wine glass, right?
Okay. Then I would look at the actual consumption experience. So, for example, how comfortable is it to actually drink liquid from the glass or not? How awkward it is not. So, for example, is the top of the opening really small, and when you try and drink, the glass might actually touch your nose or not? Oh. Or is it like a brandy balloon glass where it could be really big and you could actually need to hold two hands underneath?
Of course not. It's a wine glass. Brandy.
But, you know, these are sort of things I want to test. Is the opening too small or is it too long? So, you know, for example, is it...
definition of too small.
Well, it depends. Without specific requirements, I'd be looking at the average sort of... But maybe get a couple of people to try it. Does it feel comfortable? Does it feel good to use?
Some real people then.
I'd then start thinking more of the destructive testing. So can you just knock it over, empty it without it smashing? Can you tap them together without them smashing? Can you wash it without breaking it?
I like how you've said as long as it's not a one-off.
Yes.
That's important to check.
Yes, it is important to check. Oh, look, here's my one-off 1K special custom hand blind glass smash. Oh, look, it breaks. It doesn't pass my
breath. That was our only prototype.
Yes. So I would definitely check that. What else would I test with a wine glass? Give it to small children and see if they can smash each other the head with it. Does it break? No, I probably wouldn't do that.
Probably not. That's a lawsuit waiting to happen.
Yeah, I think so. Or if not, nothing else to get yelled at by the wife.
All right, I'll stop you because obviously I have a lot of important interview questions to get to. But
how did I do?
I'm not finished yet. Oh, I have another follow-up question. I was just letting you, seeing how far you'd go, but clearly you're going to just
keep
going.
That's the warm-up.
Yeah, so let's say 5 bugs that you could hypothetically find in this wine glass.
5 bugs I could have to find in a wine glass. Okay, so the first one is stability. Well, sure. Okay, the fundamental one doesn't actually do the job. So,
which job?
The job of holding wine.
Okay.
So if it's got a hole in the bottom, wine leaks out or it's cracked and doesn't hold wine, then that's probably the number one bug. So if it doesn't do that job, there's a bug straight away.
Yeah, assuming it's meant to hold wine.
Okay.
Sure.
So the second one would be, and again, we're looking specifically at wine, not a generic glass. So I'm not looking at can I hold spirits or anything like that, so I'm specifically focusing on wine.
Oh, only care about wine.
Well, wine, and okay, I can again ask for more assumptions. Is it only going to hold wine or not?
Well,
and when I keep asking, I keep getting these vague responses.
It's frustrating, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is. That's what requires wine.
Yes.
Okay. So the assumptions I would make. And if you wanted to ask, I'd probably document the assumptions that I was making as I asked. So these are the assumptions that I made and ask you to please verify them. Okay, so where are we at? So the other sort of bugs are stability. So how easy is it to knock? If I've gone to destructive testing, whether it's too easy to break or not.
Sure.
If it's really awkward to hold.
Yeah.
Or it's really heavy and hurts my arm when I'm, you know, if it's made of super like inch thick glass and it's really impractical.
Uh-huh.
I might raise bugs along those lines. What else would I do? If I look at the, again, it depends on the market and precision, but if I can, is the glass flawed or not? So the actual, if it's meant to be pure high class crystal, I can hold it up and I can see marks all through
clarity,
those sorts of things. If it's really, really easy just to, if it's too thin and you can just snap and break it when you're washing it, that's not a bug.
Yep.
If I've got multiple of them and I can't stack them on top of each other and do that cool champagne trick with the wine going down,
that'd be another one as well.
And if I can't play the music, can't entertain your friends with the party trick, that's another important bug.
All right, I think that hits more than 5, but anyway.
Sorry. I'm thorough.
I can see you love your job as a wine glass tester. Anyway.
Well, I prefer my job as a wine consumer, but...
Yeah, it's okay. out of those bugs, which one would you say is the most important one to fix?
Out of all those bugs, which is the most important one to fix? Okay, again, it depends on the use of the glass. Because, for example, if this is as you suggested, an ornamental glass, then the clarity one could be really important. And the actual use of the glass for drinking wine may not matter.
Sure.
Assuming it's an actual wine glass, that would probably be a bug that you wouldn't worry about because, again, it's can I consume the wine? The playing of the music is more of a secondary, so I probably wouldn't worry about that either.
Assuming it's an ornamental wine glass? Or just in all cases?
Well, playing music on top of the wine glass. Which bug can I log? Which one would I fix out of all those bugs? That's probably a secondary or third.
Well, once again, that all depends on the purpose of the wine glass, yes? It could be wine glasses specifically created for musicality.
Okay, so is this wine glass so true? Didn't I ask what is the specific purpose of this wine glass?
I know, I'm just being clear on
No, I know. again, so really, it ultimately depends on that purpose.
Sure.
Right? And I'm assuming, which I'm hoping you...
That's fine. Assume away.
For consuming wine, because you're not answering my question, this is what it's for, which is what people do in interviews. okay. So, the main bugs I would raise is if there was a fundamental bug that stopped me from pouring wine and consuming wine. So, for example, if I fill it with wine and the centre of gravity gets bang smashed, that's probably the main bug I would fix. So, the core, can it do its core intended job? Yep. Be that play music, look ornamental, or be used for consuming of the liquid. So the whichever of those bugs was the most important in impeding that function, that core functionality,
okay,
is the one I would log and fix.
So what if the business says to you, okay, so we've got these bugs, we've got all of these bugs, we can only fix the one about the clarity because that's all we've got time to fix?
Well, it depends on the real business intent and whether they want the bug to be commercially... The glass to be commercially successful, right? So it ultimately depends on the business that you're in. So if you're in the business of consuming wine and they've only got time to fix the clarity bug, you might as well ship it without even fixing that bug because the product's fundamentally flawed. It's not going to succeed in the marketplace. So who cares whether you fix the clarity bug? If you're selling it drink wine out of and you can't even do that, it's going to be a commercial failure anyway. So you may as well not fix anything. What I would tell the business if that was our core business of wine glasses to consume wine, and I would sort of question whether that they would actually want to, whether they should actually be shipping the product or not.
Okay, in what way would you question?
Well, I would say that I would strongly suggest that if the glass was to be sold in its current situation, it would not fulfill its intended function. It would be a commercial failure. And in fact, they would almost be in some ways negligent by proceeding to take it to market without fixing those bugs.
Yeah, fair enough.
At the end of the day, if they then override you, then that's their call and you go look for gainful employment somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay. Good answer.
And I've actually had to do something similar to that in real life.
I have no doubt you have. All right, well, that was my entire interview.
Yes. Yeah. Did I get the job? No.
Oh, no, sorry, we already filled that role in. I just thought you seemed like a nice guy to chat to. I just wanted to know what the real answer was, really.
So, to be honest, I actually feel like my responses are quite long-winded. And part of that is and I know... You're not deliberately not answering the questions.
Yes.
So you're deliberately trying to draw and see where I go.
Yes.
So I think I'm being overly verbose and I could answer something a lot more succinctly than what I have. All right. So, Miss Koo, co-host of Testcast on episode 3, which I think we're going to cover interviewing, let me ask you a question.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, I'm a firm believer in... And I assume this is what we're doing here, is that you don't hire a juggler without seeing them juggle. So I would never interview someone without making the test in the interview, which is exactly what we're trying to do here, I suppose, in this way. The sort of questions that I would tend to ask, an old classic bit of goodie, I'm trying to think of one that I want to ask you, but not actually give away one of the ones that I actually ask. Okay, let's say you're... testing, and I tend to, the glasses are good, but I actually would tend to use a software product that's a real software product. I'll use it on any question and I'll just change it when I ask. You're testing Notepad.
Okay.
And good old Windows Notepad. And you're testing file save.
Yep.
Okay. Tell me how many test cases you can come up with, as many as possible, as quickly as you can.
Tell you a number?
No. Tell me the test cases. I want you to come up with as many test cases as you possibly can.
Okay.
As quickly as possible.
So I'm just doing file save. All right. So there's a basic one where it's blank and I go file save. Is there a file save as or is it just file save?
I'll save it. And save us, yes.
Oh, and save us. Oh, gosh.
That's the save, the save. You are the save dialogue. That is your feature.
Oh, the whole save dialogue?
Yeah, all three buttons. Save, save as, cancel.
Isn't it just three buttons? You go save as and it's got a whole thing there with the, you know, you can type in the name and
we must have played a change test
the extension.
Let's go.
And, yeah.
That's your feature. Go.
Oh, gosh. All right. I'm just starting with simple save and then I'll move on to the save as because that's just... Okay. So, all right. It's blank and I save it. And then there's that entire input that could affect the whole save process there. Oh, my God. That's so much stuff. Okay, so...
It's only one dialogue.
No, because it is one little button, but what that button's doing is dependent on everything that's happened before it. So, okay, we've got... okay, I could put, I could make it a very, very large file, so about as, well, I don't know, what's large? For Notepad, I don't know, I'll make half a gig and I'll see if that does anything, and then I'll double that until it breaks or something like that.
Yeah.
Or, well, I suppose at first I'd go and see if anybody has a spec for me to say, what are you expecting?
Hey, it's Notepad, come on.
What
it's the file save thing. It's been in Windows for years. No, you don't need a spec for that.
Well, I got to tell you, okay, I've never tested Notepad, okay, so I don't know what its capability is supposed to be.
Here's the spec. Be Notepad.
Okay, fine. All right. Well, I'll just keep... No, I'll save a really big file, like half a gig, a gig, keep increasing it until I find out what its limit is, and then at least we'll have some information about that, and somebody else can tell me if that's bad or not. I mean, if it's this really ridiculously small limit, then...
I think it's actually...
Is it? Oh, gosh.
I think that's why there's WordPad, because Notepad sort of...
Well, okay, let's say it's like... 2 kilobytes. That's okay. Probably not acceptable.
Let's say a meg.
A meg. Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, Notepad. Okay. all right, yeah. And Notepad's just plain text, right? You can't do anything to it. It's just plain text.
Just ASCII even.
Yeah. Okay, oh, when you say save... When I save it, okay, so I'll save it and then I'll open it again, and then I'll check that when it's saved, it is when I open it again, it looks the same as when I saved it. So, for example, I can
there you go.
Oh,
that's something like that.
Hmm. What? Just the dialogue?
Yeah.
Oh, so not actually the save function, just
the dialogue.
But that's save as. That's not save.
That's save.
No.
That's save as.
Save will just save it. Save as will save it as.
That's save. Because yep. It's a new document. I haven't saved it yet. Ah,
this isn't Notepad. This is on a Mac.
Yeah, well. Look, see, new file. File, save.
Yeah, that's your feature. Fancy Mac. All right. Oh my goodness. Oh, it's got so many things. Okay. All right, so I'll save it as, let's see, a file with just ASCII characters and no spaces, .txt, which seems to be the default file extension. All right, and then I'll try a few variations on the file name, like I'll put some spaces in it, I'll put some special characters in it, I'll put some foreign characters in it, you know, the usual kind of stuff, and then I'll save it. And these ones, I'll open it again and make sure it can open.
Sorry, usual kind of stuff?
Sorry?
That counts as one test case, usual kind of stuff.
Oh, you really want me to list it? We'll be here all day. Oh, my goodness. Okay, special characters, got a character map, load up everything you can find in there, use a very, very, very long string, use a blank input, I'm going to leave input stuff alone for now because it just...
I'll come back to that.
It just bores me to death and there's just a heap of them and I know them all and I know everybody knows them and if they don't know them by now, honestly, okay, Okay, so then there's, what is this? File encoding. Hey, give me a look. UTF-8. Ah, there's like Mac Roman. I don't even know what that is.
Latin 1, Windows. See, this is Unicode. This is a Unicode.
There's six of them.
Yeah, this is actually TextMate, so it's actually a Unicode text editor, not crappy old.
Okay, so.
Big Indian, Little Indian.
So there's 6 file encoding options here. All right. I don't even know what these are, I'd have to go and check them out and find out what they're meant to do, and then I go make sure that they bloody do them.
Okay, so I think we've made our point, is that there's a ton. and what I look for when I interview someone and ask those sort of questions is, how quickly do they stop with the obvious versus keep going? So, for example, do they just go save our blank file? You know, so straight away the sort of things that I'd be starting thinking of is this is where like things like equivalence partitioning comes in. So you sort of said character maps. It's like, well, if it's only if the dialogue's only going to allow ASCII, you're really going to literally go through the whole character map and do every single one. So those sorts of things. The other sort of things I'd look at is actual lengths of the file. So I should probably do a bit of research and go, okay, well, what is the file system length? Is it 256 characters? Is it, so what's the native file system? What does that support? And then I'd go 256, and that's what it supports. Then I'd go 257.
Yeah.
So I do a boundary test around the length and things like that. Unicode into a non-Unicode, trying to paste Unicode is always good. There's Laura Ipsum, Lipsum.com.
Yeah.
It's great for that.
And so, Bacon Ipsum now.
Yeah. So that Bacon Ipsum?
Yeah, it's the meat-based version of Laura Ipsum. It's a meatier version.
What?
Yeah.
Full View is a boutique design studio that fuses creativity with strategy to create effective graphic design for web and print. To find out more about their work and services, go to www.ful-vue.com.
Bacon Ipsum.
It's delicious.
Do they have Klingon Ipsum?
They should.
Oh my god, Bacon Ipsum, a meatier lorem ipsum.
This is a revolution in lorem ipsum.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
All meat, give me bacon. Oh my god. Hey. Head cheese, short ribs, white pork, lawn meat. What? I'm so barking this.
How good is it?
That is just.
Baconipsum.com.
Awesome. I'm gonna, oh, that is just. Yeah. That is just, there's so many kinds of awesome. So that's the sort of testing it is that I ask. The other sort of things that I'm asking, that I'd like to ask is, what surprises me is when people interview. So let me ask you a question. What sort of skills do you normally look for?
I don't just look for technical skill, if that's what you mean. I mean, I look for exploratory testing skill. I mainly look to see the way that they think. I mean, in the end, I really just want to know that they're very smart, that they're a good communicator, that if they're looking at any kind of problem, be it testing or otherwise, but specifically testing because they're a tester, that they're going to approach it in a way that makes sense for the problem at hand.
Because what I find, particularly now, depends on the sort of person I'm hiring, but normally the person I try to like to hire is someone who's normally a graduate. And the reason that they're graduates is there's probably three reasons. One is they're young and keen. Well, some are. Gen Y, Gen X, Gen Y, they can be started.
Okay.
Generally, they're keen. More importantly, they don't have any preconceived notions. So they haven't learnt bad habits yet.
Right. So you want a blank slate
to them to treat in the right way. And also, hopefully they're really interested in the right sort of technologies.
Right.
So by that, what I mean is I'd be looking for someone who wants to do your Rubies and your all C# as opposed to VBA and COBOL. So you want someone who's a bit keen.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is I think those particular sort of areas, I want to look for areas where innovation's happening and where it's happening. I think there's great innovation happening in, and we sort of talked about given when then on the last episode. So all that's coming out of the Ruby space. So
yeah.
WaterOne, WebDriver, Selenium, a lot of that's in the Ruby space. There's a lot that comes out of Microsoft, whether people want it and love Microsoft or not, that does come out in the Microsoft space as well. So if people are keen and interested in those technologies, I think that's also shown that they're if you think of the technology adoption curve, they're on the right end of the adoption curve.
Yeah, true. See, I don't want somebody who's a blank slate, because I want to get somebody who's going to teach me as much as I can teach them.
Well, it depends on the level. So
that's true.
Yeah, so I'm talking about normal, hiring a normal tester.
Like a junior level tester?
Yeah. Sort of, that's sort of the normal. I suppose it's the consultancy model. The consultancy recruiting is still in my brain.
Yes.
Where the consultancy model, it's the law firm model, if that makes sense, where you have one or two really good senior people and a whole pyramid of progressively more junior people underneath, and that's how you make most of your money, right? So you've got one person who's on multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars and lots of people, you know, tens or 20 people that are on, you know, $40,000, $50,000, and you charge them out at the rate that you charge out the more senior guy. So that's still, a lot of my life has been that, so that's still part of my thinking. But I suppose the other thing too is one thing I found is when you're at the top, just to call that point, when you're at the top of an organisation, you tend to almost have your own network of peers.
Yeah.
To get that high level collaboration, because if you're at the top of your organisation, most times, even though you would want to, you can't really hire in someone at your same level, because, you know, let's have two heads of testing for, you know, Paint Corp. You know,
it does, often you can't. Yeah,
you can't do that. Why do you want to hire someone else and pay them $500,000 a year? Because I want a friend. It doesn't really fly. So. I think trying to be peering with a network of people at the same level works quite well. But yeah, so when I'm hiring those clean slates, you can then sort of teach them what you want. So my point that I was trying to head towards originally was, it surprises me when I hire someone, and normally they might have, especially if you're looking for a tester who can develop as well, and write some automation as well, what I generally find is somewhere, oh, I know 2 years of .NET. And I want to go on a bit of a voyage of discovery to find out how much they know. So, Trish, I know you know about .NET.
Yes.
So I'll give you an example of some of the questions I've got. Now, interestingly, there's two web pages on the internet.
Only two?
If two pages on the internet written by one person, if most of my candidates found those pages, I think they're called Anymax C-sharp FAQ. And if they actually went and read those and learnt what's on those two web pages, they can walk through any interview that I give.
All right, let's hit Google.
Yeah, let's hit Google. And let me...
Why are you giving away your secret?
Because I can see through that. If someone...
It's a trap.
It is a trap. It's a trap. Oh, no, it's a trap. Okay, so AnyMix C-sharp FAQ. This will be in the show notes. AndyMCM.com. Okay. Uh-huh. So this is a C-sharp FAQ for C++ programmers, and there's also a .NET FAQ. So the sort of things, I'll just pick one randomly. What are the fundamental differences between value types and reference types?
Is this the one you asked me?
No. So the fundamental... Now, I will get this wrong. I'm just going to quickly look at it. I don't know which one's on the steep heap. So the bottom line is, with value types and reference types, ultimately one is on the heap and one is on the stack.
Uh-huh.
I always get it wrong, which is which. But it's those sort of questions, and I like to answer questions where I can go unravel deeper and deeper and deeper. So, for example, I like to ask questions in .NET particularly, like, what is an assembly? And there's a technical thing about what an assembly is, and someone says, oh, it's a da-da-da. Then I'll say, okay, and then I'll go to the next question that's a bit the next level down. So I can just keep digging and digging and digging and find out. And ultimately what you want is someone going to say, I don't know something?
Yeah.
Or do they try and tell you something and just completely get it wrong? The other big thing is...
Or do they start arguing with you about the validity of the question, which, as I recall, is what I did last time you asked me one of these things.
I think so. But what I'm really trying to do is, again, in a... Because ultimately most interviews are short, right? They're half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever. I'm trying to determine, this person's saying they've spent 2 years programming in ASP.NET or programming in C#.
Yes.
Have they really been doing it? Do they have a fundamental understanding of the environment they're working in?
Sure.
And that's what you're trying to unravel really, really quickly.
Sure, but is this level of C# question, I mean, is this really the sort of level that they need to understand C# in order to work with automated testing in C#?
No, not the value type question, but things like knowing what an assembly is, knowing what the GAC, the global assembly cache, is, and knowing, actually, a very good question is like garbage collection, memory management. One of the key things that you come across in automation, particularly when you're automating in, say, Selenium or Watton, is spinning up into an explorer and shutting it down cleanly into every test.
Yes.
One of the ways that you do that is with the using statement.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of my classic interview questions is, what are the two uses of the using statement?
Uh-huh.
Right. So the two uses are, one of them is for importing namespaces, and most people get that. The other one is, it's about scoping when a variable comes along. So with Watton, you would normally go using, and you go using the Watton object, and you wrap your test in that. So it spins up into the explorer through Watton, executes the test, shuts it down, kills IE, and starts again.
Yeah.
So it's a way of giving you that isolation. Under the covers, the using statement is all about the link to garbage collection and memory management inside the .NET. So do they have to know exactly how it's working and how it's implemented down at the level? No. Do they need to know what it is and how it's used? Absolutely, because it's used all the time.
Yeah, sure.
So that's the sort of level. And so I use that sort of thing like, do they know about this piece? And then you can, it's very quickly trying to work out, you know. It's the juggler question, right? So Trish, you're a juggler. Can you juggle balls? 3 balls? 4 balls? Yes. 5 balls? Yes. 6 balls? Oh, that's cool. What about knives? Can you do knives? Oh, yeah, I can do knives. What about flame? Yeah, I can juggle flame. Okay, cool. Thank you very much. You've got the job. Like, the other thing which, so the consequence of my interviewing style is that people, when I'm interviewing, if they're doing badly, they know it. They know it very, very quickly. So it can be quite confronting for people that don't know what they're doing to be put, that aren't used to that sort of interview.
Yeah, that's true. How many testers do you actually find with that level of knowledge, though?
Well, it depends. To be honest, I'm not looking for the right or wrong.
Mm.
If someone says, I don't know, that's okay. It's if someone says, I know something, but they actually don't. That's what you're trying to find out.
Yeah, that's very true, because I know that I've interviewed some testers for automation roles, and I've said, okay, you'll need to know Java for this role. They go, yeah, I know Java. I go, okay, well, here's a programming question for you. Just write on this sheet of paper how you would reverse a string in Java. Go. And I've had them sit there and just throw up their hands and go, I can't do it, and not write a thing.
Ow. Go away, Twitterific.
Yeah, and I've had them throw up their hands and say that they just can't do it and they don't write a thing on the piece of paper. I've had them write down something completely nonsensical that isn't even Java or any kind of code I've ever seen in my life. I don't know why they'd say that they knew it in the first place, but I think I've had a few testers misunderstand when they were told that they needed Java knowledge. They thought that they meant that they had tested something written in Java. So,
It's interesting. So it's like, there's a classic. So there's two classics that I see about this. One is, if you Google for Quick Test Pro, what do you think is going to be the most common thing that comes back?
Quick Test Pro.
So the HP product Quick Test Pro. You think Quick Test Pro's website? Yes.
There's some SEO action.
So, first one, the Wikipedia entry. The second one is how to learn. But the third one, Quick Test Pro interview questions.
Ha ha.
Right. So, it's all about interview questions. Answers on how to fake your way past interviews.
Wow, fabulous.
The majority of Quick Test Pro searches on Google return back, this is interview questions that you might get asked and how to fake your way past the interview.
Wow, fantastic. Well, these aren't going to help you if somebody just puts Quick Test Pro in front of you and tells you to use it.
It's interesting you say that,
uh-huh.
Because I think we talked about Park Calc as well.
Yeah.
How do you know I'm not going to put something in front of you and say, test this application right here in front of me?
I would almost expect that in testing interviews these days.
Yeah. I think I will.
Yeah.
I think I'll do that.
You totally should.
So let me ask you another question. So Trish, let's just say hypothetically, I work for a car company.
Okay.
Now, you're coming in as a tester who has no domain knowledge.
Uh-huh.
So, Trish, how much do you know about cars and car, If you come into work here at Ford Motor Company, you know, you're a great tester, but you don't know cars. How are you going to learn about cars?
How am I going to learn about cars? Well, I'd be surrounded by car experts, so I'd start by trying to ask somebody else for advice about how I'd learn about cars. I'd probably do some research of my own online. Maybe ask. I know some people who know a lot about cars and are very into cars. I'd definitely go to them to ask for some resources.
Would you say, I don't know, read a car magazine as a way to get experience in the car industry?
I don't think that would give me any industry experience.
Is that an answer you would give in an interview?
No, I don't think it is.
That's an answer I got last week.
Well.
And, yeah, if I didn't know the guy I was interviewing, I had to laugh because I actually know him, but everyone can have a bad day.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I'm always putting my foot in my mouth, so who am I to laugh at such things?
So, resumes.
Yes.
What do you look for in a resume?
Well, less than 10 pages is an excellent start. In fact, I think 2 pages is probably sufficient for any resume, but hey, I'm not going to read the resume if it's more than about 3 or 4 pages long,
so,
to be honest.
Do you want my honest opinion?
Yes.
I don't read resumes.
At all?
Not at all, but if I... Okay, let's pick someone, Marlena Crompton.
Yes.
Right? Friend of yours. If Marlena was applying for a job,
yes,
the first thing I would do is go into Google... Is it Crompton?
C-O-M-P-T-O-N.
C-O-M-P-T-O-N.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Right. It's the first thing I do is Google for someone.
I skim the resume. I don't read all the history.
Yeah, exactly. So my point is, I think your online footprint is now becoming more and more and more important.
Oh, yeah.
It's recruiting. So if you're a tester and you... Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't... If you don't want to blog, don't blog.
Yeah.
That's something I would actually question. But ultimately, you want to control the footprint that you leave
Definitely.
Behind.
I worry about mine all the time.
And this is the whole, this is the part of the problem with the Facebook generation is you might want to think if your Facebook profile is public.
Yes.
And you've got photos that your friends have posted of you when you're out having a bender or a party.
Lock that down as much as you can.
Do you really want people like us looking for it? And the other thing, too, is if there are some bad things, you want to bury them with goodness.
Yes.
So I would say, from what I've found personally, is LinkedIn, for me, is the primary vehicle that I have used recently, both for recruiting and being recruited. In actual fact, to the point where I don't think I actually have changed jobs recently. I didn't even apply for any job online.
Hmm.
All the phone calls that I got were from my LinkedIn profile.
Yeah.
And from that. So I think that's really, really important. So that's what I would... So I tend to quickly skip a resume. At the end of the day... Actually, there is one thing which I will find in a resume. Spelling errors.
Yeah.
That, to me...
Very much so.
To me, the quality of the writing in the first part of the resume, that's what I look at far and more in the layout of the resume and the look and feel of the resume. To be honest, that has a much bigger impact.
That's what I mean about the length of the resume as well. Just have they really thought it out? Are they smart enough to go... I'm tailoring this for the job I'm applying for. It doesn't have any damn spelling errors. I mean, you're going for a job about quality, for goodness sake.
And I understand that for a lot of people, English is a second language.
Yeah.
Pay someone.
Yeah.
To read it.
Surely. You've got a friend, right?
And, like, just simple things. Like, so if one of the classic things I know coming from, I'm not sure what the exact language is, you can fill me in. I think just Chinese or Japanese, one of those languages, coming from that as your primary language to English, the pluralization. So everything, when the English, you'll tend to, so for example, there was a a restaurant menu. This is where English comes from, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's those conversions of what makes perfect sense in your native language when you write it out. That stuff. So, like Spanish, for example. Spanish is it's backwards, right?
Yeah.
The way that it's structured compared to English. So if you do a literal word-for-word translation, the sentences don't make sense.
Right.
There's things like that where get someone to review it.
Yeah.
You know, as a recruiter, I'm not going to go, oh, they didn't actually write all this text themselves. They got someone else. I don't care. It's like it's your story. It's about you.
Yeah, it's basically a professional publication. It should be treated as such.
And if you really want, I'm married to a graphic designer, so actually my resume is actually designed. But the other thing too is trying to control that vehicle as much as possible.
Yeah.
So particularly if you're dealing with a recruiter, they will want to basically take your personal details off. So it's all about them trying to control who has access to your information. So they don't necessarily want a client going to you directly. So they will want to basically take your personal information off and put their branding on there to do it. So I've actually been horrified whenever someone asks you, oh, give me your resume. Well, I can't take it in PDF, give it to us as a Word document. And it turns up and it's just been butchered because they try to whack their logo in and stuff. So again, try and facilitate your with your resume to make it so that it's easy for recruiters to do that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing too is I think a lot of resumes are also scanned and keyword done in recruiting systems as well. So I think you sort of need to be buzzword compliant as well.
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of them get quite lengthy because they're just trying to put in every single buzzword possible.
I'm not saying do this, people putting white text on white background.
Really?
So that when it prints, you can't see it, but their system is actually, with every technology they've ever touched.
Wow, okay.
So that's probably bad to do that. So I think that's about recruitment. I think that's about all I can think of off the top of my head. But basically, so my tips for a tester is practice. Prepare and practice for interviewing. When I was originally going to interview, actually was going to interview for a job at Microsoft as opposed to being a vendor working there, and I spent a day in my bedroom with a mirror. We had a big the wardrobes had mirrors, literally with a whiteboard marker writing code on essentially on the closest thing I had to a whiteboard. Because I wanted to be able, because I know that
have a whiteboard?
No, not in the house. I still do. Not in the house. No, I know this may shock you, but being me, how much I write on whiteboards. But not in the house. So I literally spent half a day or more just writing up, okay, let's write bubble sort, and just writing algorithms up in the whiteboard, because it's very different to write code in an interview situation where you don't have an IDE.
You
don't have tab completion.
Yeah, definitely.
So you need, it's a skill that you can practice.
Yeah, you need to be able to recall things that, especially if you've been using something like Visual Studio, which is filling in the blanks for you the entire time.